Chapter 57. LS plus ACE de connoiter la men general K de connoiter un amen particulier. La Roche Fau called. An hour after Grandcourt had left, the important news of Gwendolyn's engagement was known at the rectory, and Mr. and Mrs. Gaskin, with Anna, spent the evening at Offenden. My dear, let me congratulate you on having created a strong attachment, said the rector. Why, you look serious, and I don't wonder at it. A lifelong union is a solemn thing. But from the way Mr. Grandcourt has acted and spoken, I think we may already see some good arising out of our adversity. It has given you an opportunity of observing your future husband's delicate liberality. Mr. Gaskin referred to Grandcourt's mode of implying that he would provide for Mrs. Davilow a part of the lovemaking which Gwendolyn had remembered to cite to her mother with perfect accuracy. But I have no doubt that Mr. Grandcourt would have behaved quite as handsomely if you had not gone away to Germany, Gwendolyn, and had been engaged to him, as you no doubt might have been, more than a month ago, said Mrs. Gaskin, feeling that as he had to discharge a duty on this occasion. But now there is no more room for caprice. Indeed, I trust you have no inclination to any. A woman has a great debt of gratitude to a man who perseveres in making her such an offer. But no doubt you feel properly. I am not at all sure that I do, Aunt, said Gwendolyn, with saucy gravity. I don't know everything it is proper to feel on being engaged. The rector patted her shoulder and smiled, as at a bit of innocent naughtiness, and his wife took his behavior as an indication that she was not to be displeased. As for Anna, she kissed Gwendolyn and said, I do hope you will be happy, but then sank into the background, and tried to keep the tears back too. In the late days as he had been imagining a little romance about Rex Howe, if he still longed for Gwendolyn her heart might be softened by trouble into love, so that they could by and by be married. And the romance had turned to a prayer that she, Anna, might be able to rejoice like a good sister, and only think of being useful in working for Gwendolyn, as long as Rex was not rich. But now she wanted Grace to rejoice in something else. Miss Mary and the four girls, Alice with the high shoulders, Bertha and Fanny the whisperers, and Isabel the listener, were all present on this family occasion, when everything seemed appropriately turning to the honor and glory of Gwendolyn, and real life was as interesting as her Charles Grandison. The evening passed chiefly in decisive remarks from the rector, in answer to conjectures from the two elder ladies. According to him, the case was not one in which he could think it his duty to mention settlements. Everything must, and doubtless would safely be left to Mr. Grandcourt. I should like to know exactly what sort of places Rylands and Gadsmere are, said Mrs. Davilow. Gadsmere, I believe, is a secondary place, said Mr. Gaskin, but Rylands I know to be one of our finest seats. The park is extensive, and the woods of a very valuable order. The house was built by Inigo Jones, and the ceilings are painted in the Italian style. The estate is said to be worth $12,000 a year, and there are two livings, one a rectory, and the gift of the Grandcourts. There may be some burdens on the land. Still, Mr. Grandcourt was an only child. It would be most remarkable, said Mrs. Gaskin, if he were to become Lord Stannery in addition to everything else. Only think. There is the Grandcourt estate, the Malinger estate, and the baronetcy, and the peerage. She was marking off the items on her fingers, and paused on the fourth while she added, but they say there will be no land coming to him with the peerage. It seemed a pity there was nothing for the fifth finger. The peerage, said the rector, judiciously, must be regarded as a remote chance. There are two cousins between the present peer and Mr. Grandcourt. It is certainly a serious reflection how death and other causes do sometimes concentrate inheritances on one man. But an excess of that kind is to be deprecated. to be Sir Mallinger Grandcourt Mallinger. I suppose that will be his style with corresponding properties, is a valuable talent enough for any man to have committed to him. Let us hope it will be well used. And what a position for the wife, Gwendolyn, said Mrs. Gaskin. A great responsibility indeed. But you must lose no time in writing to Mrs. Mumford, Henry. It is a good thing that you have an engagement of marriage to offer as an excuse, else she might feel offended. She is rather a high woman. I am rid of that horror, thought Gwendolyn, to whom the name of Mumford had become a sort of mumbo-jumbo. She was very silent through the evening, and that night could hardly sleep at all in her little white bed. It was a rarity in her strong youth to be wakeful, and perhaps a still greater rarity for her to be careful that her mother should not know of her restlessness. But her state of mind was altogether new. She who had been used to feel sure of herself, and ready to manage others, had just taken a decisive step which she had beforehand thought that she would not take, nay, perhaps, was bound not to take. She could not go backward now. She liked a great deal of what lay before her, and there was nothing for her to like if she went back. But her resolution was dogged by the shadow of that previous resolve which had at first come as the undoubting movement of her whole being. While she lay on her pillow with wide open eyes, looking on darkness which the blind do see, she was appalled by the idea that she was going to do what she had once started away from with repugnance. It was new to her that a question of right or wrong in her conduct should rouse her terror. She had known no compunction that atoning caresses and presents could not lay to rest. But here had come a moment when something like a new consciousness was awaked. She seemed on the edge of adopting deliberately, as a notion for all the rest of her life, what she had rashly said in her bitterness, when her discovery had driven her away to Lubrin. That it did not signify what she did. She had only to amuse herself as best she could. That lawlessness, that casting away of all care for justification, suddenly frightened her. It came to her with the shadowy array of possible calamity behind it, calamity which had ceased to be a mere name for her, and all the infiltrated influences of disregarded religious teaching, as well as the deeper impressions of something awful and inexorable enveloping her, seemed to concentrate themselves in the vague conception of avenging power. The brilliant position she had longed for, the imagined freedom she would create for herself in marriage, the deliverance from the dull insignificance of her girlhood all immediately before her, and yet they had come to her hunger like food with the taint of sacrilege upon it, which she must snatch with terror. In the darkness and loneliness of her little bed, her more resistant self could not act against the first onslaught of dread after her irrevocable decision. That unhappy-faced woman and her children Grandcourt, and his relations with her kept repeating themselves in her imagination like the clinging memory of a disgrace, and gradually obliterated all other thought, leaving only the consciousness that she had taken those scenes into her life. Her long wakefulness seemed a delirium. A faint, faint light penetrated beside the window curtain, the chillness increased. She could bear it no longer, and cried, "Emma!" "Yes, dear," said Mrs. Davilow, immediately, in a wakeful voice. "Let me come to you." She soon went to sleep on her mother's shoulder, and slept until late, when, dreaming of a lit-up ballroom, she opened her eyes on her mother standing by the bedside with a small packet in her hand. "I am sorry to wake you, darling, but I thought it better to give you this at once. The groom has brought Criterion. He has come on another horse, and says he is to stay here." Gwendolyn sat up in bed, and opened the packet. It was a delicate enameled casket, and inside was a splendid diamond ring with a letter which contained a folded bit of colored paper and these words: "Pray wear this ring when I come at 12 in sign of our betrothal. I enclose a check drawn in the name of Mr. Gaskin, for immediate expenses. Of course Mrs. Davilow will remain a defendant, at least for some time. I hope, When I come, you will have granted me an early day, when you may begin to command me at a shorter distance. Yours devotedly, H.M. Grand Court. The checks was for £500, and Gwendolyn turned it toward her mother, with the letter. How very kind and delicate, said Mrs. Davilow, with much feeling. But I really should like better, not to be dependent on a son-in-law. I and the girls could get along very well. Mama, if you say that again, I will not marry him, said Gwendolyn, angrily. My dear child, I trust you are not going to marry only for my sake, said Mrs. Davilow, depreciatingly. Gwendolyn tossed her head on the pillow away from her mother, and let the ring lie. She was irritated at this attempt to take away a motive. Perhaps the deeper cause of her irritation was the consciousness that she was not going to marry solely for her mama's sake, that she was drawn toward the marriage in ways against which stronger reasons than her mother's renunciation were, yet not strong enough to hinder her. As he had waked up to the signs that she was irrevocably engaged, and all the ugly visions, the alarms, the arguments of the night, must be met by daylight, in which probably they would show themselves weak. W. What I long for is your happiness, dear, continued Mrs. Davilow, pleadingly. I will not say anything to vex you. Will you not put on the ring? For a few moments Gwendolyn did not answer, but her thoughts were active. At last she raised herself with a determination to do as she would do if he had started on horseback, and go on with spirit, whatever ideas might be running in her head. I thought the lover always put on the betrothal ring himself, she said laughingly, slipping the ring on her finger, and looking at it with a charming movement of her head. I know why he has sent it, she added, nodding at her mama. Why? He would rather make me put it on than ask me to let him do it. Aha! He is very proud. But so am one. We shall match each other. I should hate a man who went down on his knees and came fawning on me. He really is not disgusting. That is very moderate praise, Gwen. No, it is not, for a man, said Gwendolyn gaily. But now I must get up and dress. Will you come and do my hair, Mama, dear, she went on, drawing down her mama's face to caress it with her own cheeks, and not be so naughty anymore as to talk of living in poverty? You must bear to be made comfortable, even if you don't like it. And Mr. Grandcourt behaves perfectly now, does he not? Certainly he does, said Mrs. Davilow, encouraged, and persuaded that after all Gwendolyn was fond of her betrothed. She herself thought him a man whose attentions were likely to tell on a girl's feeling. Suitors must often be judged as words are, by the standing and the figure they make in polite society. It is difficult to know much else of them. And all the mother's anxiety turned not on Grandcourt's character, but on Gwendolyn's mood in accepting him. The mood was necessarily passing through a new phase this morning. Even in the hour of making her toilet, as he had drawn on all the knowledge as he had for grounds to justify her marriage. And what she most dwelt on was the determination that when she was Grandcourt's wife, she would urge him to the most liberal conduct toward Mrs. Glasher's children. Of what use would it be to her that I should not marry him? He could have married her if he liked, but he did not like. Perhaps she is to blame for that. There must be a great deal about her that I know nothing of. And he must have been good to her in many ways, else she would not have wanted to marry him. But that last argument at once began to appear doubtful. Mrs. Glasher naturally wished to exclude other children who would stand between Grandcourt and her own. And Gwendolyn's comprehension of this feeling prompted another way of reconciling claims. Perhaps we shall have no children. I hope we shall not. And he might leave the estate to the pretty little boy. My uncle said that Mr. Grandcourt could do as he liked with the estates. Only when Sir Hugo Mallinger dies there will be enough for two. This made Mrs. Glasher appear quite unreasonable in demanding that her boy should be sole heir, and the double property was a security that Grand Court's marriage would do her no wrong. When the wife was Gwendolyn Arleth with all her proud resolution not to be fairly accused. This maiden had been accustomed to think herself blameless. Other persons only were faulty. It was striking that in the hold which this argument of her doing no wrong to Mrs. Glasher had taken on her mind, her repugnance to the idea of Grand Court's past had sunk into a subordinate feeling. The terror she had felt in the night watches at overstepping the border of wickedness by doing what she had at first felt to be wrong, had dulled any emotions about his conduct. She was thinking of him, whatever he might be, as a man over whom she was going to have indefinite power, and her loving him having never been a question with her, any agreeableness he had, was so much gain. Poor Gwendolyn had no awe of unmanageable forces in the state of matrimony, but regarded it as altogether a matter of management, in which she would know how to act. In relation to Grand Court's past she encouraged new doubts, whether he were likely to have differed much from other men, and she devised little schemes for learning what was expected of men in general. But whatever else might be true in the world, her hair was dressed suitably for riding, and she went down in her riding habit, to avoid delay, before getting on horseback. She wanted to have her blood stirred once more with the intoxication of youth, and to recover the daring with which she had been used to think of her course in life. Already a load was lifted off her, for in daylight and activity it was less oppressive to have doubts about her choice than to feel that she had no choice but to endure insignificance and servitude. "Go back and make yourself look like a duchess, Mama," she said, turning suddenly as she was going downstairs. "Put your point lace over your head. I must have you look like a duchess. You must not take things humbly." When Grand Court raised her left hand gently and looked at the ring, she said gravely, "It was very good of you to think of everything and send me that packet." "You will tell me if there is anything I forget?" he said, keeping the hand softly within his own. I will do anything you wish. But I am very unreasonable in my wishes," said Gwendolyn, smiling. "Yes, I expect that. Women always are." "Then I will not be unreasonable," said Gwendolyn, taking away her hand and tossing her head saucily. I will not be told that I am what women always are." "I did not say that," said Grand Court, looking at her with his usual gravity. "Why, you are what no other woman is." "And what is that, pray?" said Gwendolyn, moving to a distance with a little air of menace. Grand Court made his pause before he answered. "Why, you are the woman I love." "Oh, what nice speeches," said Gwendolyn, laughing. The sense of that love which he must once have given to another woman under strange circumstances was getting familiar. "Give me a nice speech in return. Say when we are to be married." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.